since they were little children. Little kids, and they were singing hate songs in the refugee camp. So it's that sort of thing that what we have to do is we have to monitor aggression. And we have to combine these approaches and not look at it as a stepwise progression like we're prone to do in the West in a linear fashion. And remember, we've talked throughout this course, and today is going to be somewhat of an encapsulation trying to help you, you know, integrate these different concepts. We talked about five different kinds of aggression. Would anyone like to share what those five different kinds of aggression are?
Physical.
Physical, which is violence, right? Physical violence. What are the other four?
Verbal, written.
Yeah. Electronic, internet.
Electronic, internet. And
radio, or that kind of thing?
That would probably be electronic also.
Symbolic.
One more. Symbolic. Good. Symbolic aggression, especially when people start using religious symbols, citations of holy books. They start exploiting the violence engineering potential of a religious festival when there are masses of people. And people's passions are high, religious passions are high. I mean, Susan, you and Michael know about the fact that even during, when was it? I was interested to see this. During the walk in Jerusalem, it was a Holy Week walk.
Palm Sunday walk.
There were groups that were trying to bait people along the way. Lots of people, religious fervor, great recipe. If you want to engineer some violence, great time to do it. Consistent with the theory we talked about yesterday, the theory of moral violation, which basically says that it's much more likely that you're going to have violence when one group can be felt that they have been offended by another group to the point of having a moral affront. In other words, not only has there been something wrong done, has there been an injustice done, but more importantly, they deserve to be punished. I mean, and in fact, not only do they deserve to be punished, we have a moral obligation to punish them. So it's like this friend of mine, Clark McCauley, wrote in one of his articles, as soon as you start seeing leaders use religious imagery, religious symbols, etc., in their rhetoric that is prone towards violence, pull out the body bags. Because it's going to happen. It is so acute, the emotional escalation that occurs there, like we talked about last night in the at Vespers. On the negative side, you've got these emotions of anger, fear, frustration, disgust. And on the positive side, you've got certain states of being that, you know, you could argue that you have to cultivate through spiritual disciplines. Or through spiritual processes where you invoke the power of the Holy Spirit. Okay, so we've reviewed these three different approaches, and what I want to do is I want to go back to a flow chart of what we had talked about yesterday, just to try to drive home the point about philanthropic investment. And I'm going to do two of them today. It's a subject that we're trying to cover today.
Say, Joe, what's that long Greek word that starts with the E?
With the E?
Yeah, he's trying to write it.
Epiclesis.
Right. Right. That's, as I understand it, and some of you, perhaps Susan, you know more about this than I do, but I'm just saying that that is apparently embraced within the Lutheran tradition as well as in the Greek.
In the liturgy, the place
where that, the formal place where that occurs is at the time of the Holy Communion, during the blessing of the bread and wine, after one has used the words of institution, then the point at which one says, makes reference to the Holy Spirit blessing these gifts and the people gathered and to make them the body of Christ in the world. That's called the epiclesis. So indeed what you're doing there is you're calling forth, invoking the Holy Spirit to make these things operate, you know, to make them powerful. So yeah, that's the place that we use that word most often.
That's great. I've also learned, it's delightful to be here among so many Lutherans. I've also learned this morning that Lutherans don't tell their children in Sunday school that you have to be baptized to get to heaven. So that's a correction also to the presentation of last night. So I stand corrected as, you know, a young Catholic going through, you know, Baltimore Catechism, getting it pounded in our heads every religion class, so.
Fourth strike.
Pardon me?
Fourth strike.
That's a fourth strike, got beyond that. And I forgot to tell you what the third strike was. The third strike was bringing up rock and roll in a sermon. I figured Sue wouldn't like that either. She didn't seem to mind it. Okay. Now, Sue told me yesterday, and if this isn't helpful, I'll stop. Sue doesn't like my flow charts.
I like them.
But I think for those of you who have studied, who have been in business, who have studied business, let me share with you a brief.
Well, it depends on how one learns.
Yeah. It really does.
I find it very helpful.
Okay, great.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
That's solidarity with
Sue. I was trying to protect the group.
Okay, I mean, there was a if any of you have ever read Peter Singhay's book, The Fifth Discipline, in the back of the book is almost this disclosure of a closet enlightenment computer whiz kit. And basically there is a taxonomy of system structure, which a group of scientists, largely out of Dartmouth and MIT, have been working on, but now it's worldwide. But it started by a person named Jay Forrester at MIT. It's called system dynamics. If any of you remember the Club of Rome controversy, the limits to growth environmental simulation model, that was a system dynamics model. In any case, what these people are trying to do is they're trying to develop a taxonomy of systems, including those that are social systems. And one of the taxonomies that was identified in the back of Peter Singhay's book was something called the growth and underinvestment system archetype. And the case study that system archetype is based upon is called, was written by an MIT professor named John Sturman, and it's, I'm sorry, Sturman wrote the computer simulation model based on a case study written by somebody at Harvard. And it's on People Express Airlines. The case study was done by Harvard Business School. Now, People Express Airlines experienced almost went into bankruptcy, and then they were bought out. And basically, the structure of the system was that they were seeking for a high performance standard. They were seeking they saw that their performance standard was lacking because they started getting too much demand. They had low prices. This was a low fare airline. And what was difficult was maintaining quality relative to the pronounced demand that they experienced. They had a perceived need to invest in capacity. They invested in capacity. There was a delay. And this is why they almost went bankrupt. There was a delay between the time that they were able to invest and the effect of that investment in their quality. It was the delay that killed them. So there was a delay before it actually affected capacity. So it's all based on, you know, feedback structure, like those of you who have studied general systems theory. Anyway, this is the basic structure that they identified in this growth and underinvestment system. Now, what we've got is harmony is the standard by which we measure interfaith goodwill. If it starts deteriorating, then we have concern about tension and conflict, which makes us invest in promotive and preventive activities. Remember, we just talked about those. There's a delay in the effect of those activities before you get a collective control of emotions. Remember, the negative emotions on the side of the sword versus the positive states of being on the side of the butter knife. So, put in a flowchart form that I briefly put up yesterday and successfully drove Sue nuts when I did it. I'm just joking. Remember, these are flows. These are sources and sinks. You don't need to worry about them. You can't get a whole system in a system dynamics model, so you have to have boundaries, and you use sources and sinks for that. These are accumulations. These are rates. So the dimension here is people. The dimension here is time, where we've got weeks on these two, where you're investing in promotive and preventive activities. Okay? It takes a while for that to result in ethno-religious, or we could call it interfaith goodwill. Why is there a delay? Well, we talked about this yesterday. For there to be a true change in critical consciousness, according to the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire, you have to encounter three things. And social marketers that try to change behavior through social marketing agree with this. I've spoken to some of them. People in PSI, working with PSI in Pakistan. Three things: awareness, reflection, action. If all you're doing is doing a public television show and people become aware about something and they might reflect on it a little bit, but they never take action, you have not raised critical consciousness to the point that you've changed their lives. That's what Paulo Freire, the famous Brazilian educator, argues in his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. So, interpreting that into this, even though they've encountered, they may have had awareness, they may have had reflection, they may not have had action. And even if they do, it's going to take a while for them to do that. And eventually, people who have goodwill towards those of other faiths. So there's a delay. So what happens is you start getting a societal tension, and the social service agencies, the churches, the religious leaders, they start to say, oh, we've got to have interfaith dialogue. We've got to, you know, have some programs at our church. And they start investing in these activities. There's a delay. In the meantime, there's a religious festival, and you get people using violence engineering. You get some skinheads who come into town and get people all riled up. You have some sort of a religious event, and they can rapidly deplete anybody in here. You see the point? And the only counteraction to that is preemption. Preemption is an attempt to prevent a rapid outflow as compared to the gradual process of building interfaith goodwill. Now, are there any questions about this? Sue?
Well, it seemed like you were saying about the incident of visiting that slum with Father Cedric initially that so disturbed you. The delay was not the factor. They already had that sense of goodwill and harmony that had been cultivated over months,
right,
or longer. So that wasn't the only problem.
Right.
So yeah. It's not just the delay,
you're
saying it's separate from preemptive activities.
Right.
The lack of that.
The real problem is that if we could use the justice scale, by far the majority of the investment, if you look at it from the standpoint of philanthropic investment, by far the majority of the investment is over here. So you've got the scale like this. Whereas the preemption, you know, the focus on preemption is over here. And it's not just a financial thing, it's an emphasis thing. Because as we've talked about before, it is not a pleasant thing to confront aggression. The five kinds of aggression that we've talked about. I mean, it's not pleasant at all. Particularly when you're going to do it in a co-religionist fashion. You're confronting your colleagues. You're using your credibility, your legitimacy, to try to confront your co-religionist colleagues, Christian to Christian, Muslim to Muslim, Jew to Jew, Hindu to Hindu, Buddhist to Buddhist. You're not going to get up and be able to do the heroic thing of standing up for your group relative to another group, which is what is most often done, which often escalates tension rather than reduces it. You've got to do the hard thing of confronting your co-religionists, like what we saw yesterday in the encounter between Lauren, Pastor Lauren, the Lutheran pastor, and Reverend Falwell. It was that needs to take place. And it has to happen early with aggression, not just to preempt violence, but to stand up to aggression and counteract aggression at early stages. Yes?
It seems to me you're making a really strong analogy with capital of investment and depletion and expenditure.
Right.
I wonder whether there are limits to that model that you've found in your experience, or whether it feels like a good match in all situations, or, I mean, goodwill is, I mean, when I think building up goodwill could be thought of that way, but not isn't necessarily, that's
right.
Not the only way to think about it, and I just wondered if you thought about that.
I think it's limited in its utility. I mean, it's largely a way of thinking about it that helps, I think it's helpful, at least for me, to understand the importance of preventing the rapid depletion and making sure that you get some balanced investment. I don't want to just use a, you know, kind of a capitalist
analogy. I meant
right.
Economics as a model.
Right, economics, right. Not right, right. No, but I want to talk a little bit about why I do think, even though it's largely this, that I don't think that it should be this.
Okay.
And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Yes.
I missed yesterday's lecture, but I'm an executive of a not-for-profit, and emphasis, my department is fundraising, and so I'm fairly familiar with a lot of what you're talking about here. If I could distill it, I want to see if I've got it distilled down correctly. What are the big elements you're saying to intervention, the top right?
Investment in preemptive activities?
Would be to have your religious leaders or your political leaders or all the people in power to be getting together, calling each other up, doing email, getting together, trying to find a forum or a way to get better relationships and to encourage tolerance of one another.
Yes, that's right. No, that's right. But
you need to have collaboration among the leaders of the not-for-profits, as well as whatever investment we're making each not-for-profit in what we're trying to do.
Right. What I'm emphasizing, though, is that it needs to be with your co-religionists. And that what you want to do.
What do you mean by co-religionists? I guess I missed that definition.
No, it's okay. A Christian would if you've got a Christian religious militant who's gone beyond being nationalistic and has become militant, it's most effective in confronting that person if that person is of the same religion. You see what I mean? So let's just say, I pulled this largely from experience in the Middle East, but this might be Christian, this might be Muslim, this might be Jewish. And you've got co-religionists, you know, violence preventing, confronting, violence promoting. on each of these. And we've talked about earlier in the course of how you really need another dimension. You need the civil society dimension. You've got the religious dimension. You need the civil society dimension.
Which is partly what I mentioned.
Right. So you would have this person who is a violence-promoting leader actually aligning him or herself with a politician who is also promoting violence. Uh-huh. And so what you need is a civic leader, like in our simulation yesterday, the head of the Chamber of Commerce or somebody like that, who can dialogue with that politician. And you need a religious leader who can dialogue with the violence-promoting religious leader.
Of the same religion.
Of the same religion, right. But you still need to have communication to the point of being able to monitor, you know, what we might be saying as Christians regarding Muslims right now might be very offensive to Muslims, and we don't even know it. So we need a Muslim moderate religious leader to tell us what we've said is seen as aggressive, and that we need to get this person in check. We need to have a discussion with that person, and we've talked about different approaches to doing that. Sometimes it may be advisable to do it behind closed doors, not confronting them in public. Sometimes if that doesn't work, you have to confront them in public, because the issue is this. If you're not careful, the conflict promoting authority figure is going to get the vast number of potential followers to be following him or her rather than the inverse. It was just like last night. I mean, the tightly bundled group that I mentioned of the Muslim leader Abdul Zafar Khan in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan, who got the nonviolent Servants of God Pushtu speakers, the same group as the Taliban, was able to do this with the potential followers, whereas the Taliban were able to do this. It's a function of religious leadership. That's why religious leadership is so critical. And incidentally, I want to give you one bit of information that I forgot to cover regarding the Fundamentalism Project. There was an analysis done of propensity of different religions towards violence. You know which religion comes out number one? Christianity. Number two, Islam. At the bottom, Buddhism. That's changing a little bit with Sri Lanka right now, but this is quantitative analysis. Lewis Fry Richardson's database that he worked on years ago in a famous book in international relations called Statistics on Deadly Quarrels.
Do you know how they came up with that as far as, like, what are the, those are obviously based on statistics, and, you know, basically the statistics?
They looked at number of battle deaths.
Okay, so it's not like the day-to-day violence.
It's more of just war proneness, right.
Well, look at the holy wars.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right. But I mean, I'm no expert on that database. It was just one of the points that they made in this Fundamentalism Project. They did try to make a bit of an assessment as to which religions tend to be more violent. And it may not have everything to do with religion. It may be that there are certain countries that have certain religious identities that have had leadership that pulls them in that direction. But again, it's largely a question of, do you go this way or do you go that way? And what is the major thrust? You know, you can always find, this is one thing that I learned in Jerusalem with this Track 2 anti-incitement project that we had. You can always find passages of sacred texts that are going to justify becoming bigoted, nationalistic, and maybe even violent. What you have to do is you have to emphasize that the major thrust of your religion is in the direction of peace and justice. And you have to help people not take things out of context and get their collective emotions under control. So I just wanted to emphasize emphasize this, and now I want to go back to something, you know, the subject of today, which is really, what should you invest in? Invest in your time, your energy, your money. I think it needs to be both. It shouldn't just be promotive preventive, nor should it just be preemptive. I think that the sessions at the end of church where you know, coffee and donuts, and you invite the Muslim mosque goers over, or your church goes to a mosque and has a joint interfaith service, those things are great. I think you've got to do that. I think it forms a foundation. And let me share with you a story of how important, that highlights how important that is. When I was when we were living in Pakistan, we funded, there was a project that we funded in a city called Toba Teksing. It's in the Punjab province, and there's a really horrible, violent tension between Sunni and Shia Muslims in that area of Pakistan. And so we funded a series of projects that were some of dubious effect, others seemed to work real well. The one that seemed to work real well that I was really surprised about was emphasizing interfaith harmony among labor union leaders and members who already had a foundation of understanding of solidarity among their fellow workers in their trade. That seemed to work better than, I mean, I couldn't believe how well that one worked. We had sports events, again, explicit theme, preventive approach. What was astounding was the one, and I may have mentioned this in a previous class, where we invited poets from all over Pakistan to come to a poetry reading in Toba Teksing, you know, big outdoor, you know, set speakers up, had food, you know, invited them from all over the place. The theme that they needed to write their poetry on was interfaith harmony. Poets came from all over Pakistan, sat down, ate the food. Nobody went up to the loudspeakers. Oh. Nobody had written a poem. Mm-hmm. Oh. Nobody really had an appreciation for interfaith harmony. Oh, a complete failure of a project.
You fed them, right.
But it goes to show you that, you know, none of the muftis in their mosques had been having coffee and donuts, they hadn't been doing the promotive and the preventive. You see what I mean? So you've got to have a balance in terms of philanthropic investment. Yes?
Well, when you talked before about having, when you were planning it, did you have a representative from that culture, maybe in that culture? Is that the kind of thing that's just...
Well, I was working, and it's a good question. I mean, we probably violated every community development principle that has ever been invented. No, we were working with a Catholic priest who was very actively involved in peace issues there. And, you know, it's unbelievable. Some of the poets out of Pakistan are, I mean, they're these revered people. It's really a place where poetry is very much appreciated. So we thought it would be a good way to do it. So in that sense, we did involve him. We should have involved some of the poets. I think that was our fundamental mistake.
You wouldn't classify that as, you couldn't say that non-intellectual events are more potent than intellectual events, so to speak. You mentioned sports and labor unions. You know, I would classify those as non-intellectual media versus poetry or whatever is other thing you're talking about. You don't see a bias toward one of the, on those basis, do you?
No, I don't. I mean, I've never really thought of that, but I think I would say, would you consider journalists to be more the intellectual
I would.
Because we did have a journalism project. This was a different group. It was called the Christian Studies Center in Rawalpindi, right outside of Islamabad. They pulled together, and we funded it. This was Catholic Relief Services funding it. It was the Kellogg Foundation that funded the other one through my fellowship. We were able to fund it out of that. And the Christian Studies Center pulled together journalists in Pakistan. This might be a good thing to be done in this country, to make sure, to talk to them about the need to highlight good stories of cooperation between, say, Sunnis and Shias, or between Christians and Muslims, or Muslims and Hindus, rather than always focusing on negative events. So there were really just a series of workshops that the Christian Studies Center had for the journalists. And that seemed to work really well. So in that sense, I guess I would say that I think that both intellectuals and non-intellectuals, it would work. Okay, so I think we've covered this. Another thing that I want to talk about, and it was part of our subject matter for yesterday, and we didn't have time to really get into this yesterday, but one of the things I want to help you with are some of the strategies you can use if you are encountering an aggressive person. Let's say that you've got an aggressive, religious, what oftentimes we would call a religious fanatic, who may be bordering on, bigotry in the direction of aggression towards people of another group. What do you do? Well, there are lots of different approaches. I know that Sue and Jessica got some training in, I believe it was in Jerusalem, with the Christian Peacemaker team. And Sue, one of the things out of that you mentioned that I thought was really helpful was that you've got to get them to say yes. You want to explain that?
Oh, just when people are arguing or fighting, you want to get them to a point of saying yes about something, anything. Is it a pretty day outside? It can be superfluous to the argument, just to diffuse the tension. That's what all that strategy was.
And the whole strategy of Christian Peacemaker team is to get in the way of aggression. That's their theme, getting in the way. And that's a physical thing. They literally put their bodies in between one group that is being aggressive towards another group.
Deflecting sometimes.
Right. And because of the in a sense, the psychology of this oftentimes is that this other group isn't really human. I mean, people go through a series of almost indoctrination that, these people aren't human. This social psychologist, Clark McCauley, he talks about during World War II how, we basically had images of the Japanese as cockroaches, whereas the Germans, we understood them as being more human. And our treatment of the prisoners of war reflected that. And so, I mean, in a sense, if you, in your mind understand that person from this other group as a cockroach, and then somebody who's not a cockroach, obviously an American, from a different country, probably has, Nikes on rather than sandals or whatever, walks in a baseball hat, they walk up and they put themselves in the way, they're not going to kill a human when they were about ready to shoot at a cockroach. And then they get arguing, and as Sue was saying, the Christian Peacemaker team, they try to get them to say yes somehow. I think it's a helpful approach. I also want to talk with you about when you're in a less dramatic physical aggression sort of thing, when you're trying to talk them out of, in a way we talked about gatekeeping and nudging in our different approaches, where you're gatekeeping in terms of theology, but you're trying to nudge them out of aligning themselves with, bigoted political figures. And what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about interest-based negotiation. Is anybody here familiar with interest-based negotiation? It's been popularized in a book called Getting to Yes, or also Beyond Machiavelli is like the second generation of that. And it tends to have three, and I'm going to say four major components, and I'll just list those for you unless somebody else wants to do that. First of all, what you want to do is you want to identify the interests rather than the positions of the people. So like yesterday, Lauren could have asked Jerry Falwell, Pastor Lauren could have asked Jerry Falwell, what are your interests? I'm trying to understand, are you against having all Muslims in our community? What really are your interests here? You want to preserve the purity, so-called, of the Christians, and you don't want them commingling? In other words, your position or your position here is you don't want the mosque to be built. But what's your interest? You have to get at the interest. So that's number one. Number two, you want to get people in a quiet, private setting so that they can brainstorm about unconventional solutions to what they've been saying. Okay, you're saying you don't want a mosque built in this neighborhood. What might be another way of dealing with what your interests are? You have a question?
No.
Okay.
Just
a fly. Okay. So that's number two. Allow people to express their unconventional ideas openly in a safe environment. Number three, look for win-win. I mean, look for something that people of all sides can agree to that is a win-win rather than a win-lose. Oftentimes people get stuck in a certain position and they're only able to come up with win-lose solutions rather than win-win solutions, as political scientists would call it, a positive-sum game. You want to identify positive-sum games. And then finally, if you're in a negotiation situation, and this leads into the second point I want to make, if you're in a negotiation system, you always need to remember what your BATNA is. Does anybody know what that is?
Best alternative to a negotiated agreement.
That's right. You want to say that again?
Best alternative to a negotiated agreement.
That's right. And how does that work, Joe? Can you explain? I'm walking in and I've got my BATNA in my hip pocket. And I'm negotiating, I'm looking for a win-win.
Right.
What's the point of the BATNA?
Well, if you can't agree, if you're not going to succeed in a negotiation, what's the best thing you can fall back on that you do have total control on?
Right. If you can't get agreement on a win-win, then you need to know what you're going to fall back on and make sure that the other people know what that is, because you always have that ability to do that. The best alternative to a negotiated agreement, which in this particular case, you know, Pastor Lauren in talking with Reverend Falwell, or Gary talking to Stan in our simulation yesterday, they would have a best alternative to a negotiated agreement of going to the American Civil Liberties Union and filing a lawsuit against the City of Tranquility for having a different procedure for approving mosques as compared to churches. Mm-hmm. And you could say things like, now do you really want the City of Tranquility to be on the front page of the New York Times as a bigoted community? You know, getting this negative publicity? You see what I mean? And so you've got your best alternative to a negotiated agreement right there. So those are the four main components of interest-based negotiation that are in a book by Roger Fisher and William Ury, U-R-Y, called Getting to Yes. And it's derived out of the Harvard Negotiation Project at Harvard Law School. Those are the four main components. Now, I've got, interest-based negotiation kind of up here as a, straw person, and I'm gonna take a little bit of a whack at it for just a second, okay? And the reason I'm going to do that is because I want you to understand a little bit about another approach called the elicitive approach. The elicitive approach is when you elicit from people how they solve their problems, how they solve their conflicts. And hence the word elicitive. Now, in cross-cultural activities, oftentimes it's really important to be able to listen to them like we didn't do with the poets in Pakistan. It's really important to listen to them. And you, not only do you need to listen to what their approaches are, do you have elders in your community? What role does the Mufti have within this Muslim community? You know? What role do women have within this fundamentalist group? Etc. Okay? So you identify key people and ways, key ways that they resolve tension and conflict. And you also elicit their words, their stories, that help people understand what you're talking about. So, someone, I'm not sure if he's been here before, but you've got his book in the bookstore named John Paul Letterock. He's now at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame, but he used to be at Eastern Mennonite University, and one of his books is in your bookstore here. He is the developer of the elicitive approach. He's done a lot of cross-cultural sorts of work, and his the book that explains this is Preparing for Peace. It's published by Syracuse University Press, and I highly recommend it. And it would be a good read also while you're reading Getting BS, if you feel like reading both of them. But the funny thing is that he went down into Latin America and he started doing interest-based negotiation, and for some reason the people in Latin America just couldn't get a handle on what this BATNA was. It wasn't computing. It was like there was a mental block. And so he talked with them for a long time, and he kept trying to explain it. And finally somebody raised his or her hand and said, "Oh, I know what you mean. Salad is better than nothing." And that was a common phrase in their culture. When you go somewhere and they don't have any meat during the meal, salad is better than nothing. So if you don't get the meat in the negotiation, at least you can get the salad. And that was their understanding of BATNA. So sometimes it is important, I would say even in our own country, we may be dealing with an inner city community that has different language, a different way of looking at things. We may be dealing with people in an Orthodox Jewish community that's very tightly held together socially and doesn't get out a whole lot. They have a different way of looking at things. They have different words, different stories. And you have to get a handle on those things. So it may be that when you're building this network of religious leaders and community leaders who are involved in trying to prevent to counteract aggression, that part of the discussion of forming this network of people and of having promotive and preventive sort of activities would be to just learn what are some of your ways of resolving conflict in your communities? So that when you get involved in these kind of relaying of information, you can say, maybe you want to contact, the chief rabbi or whatever it is that affects their community, or maybe the Muslim poet, would be the right one for you to be in contact with to try to get this thing turned around. Or maybe it's a particularly revered mufti who has got a lot of respect in your community, and maybe they need to recite this poem or tell this story or whatever. So it's important, I think, to combine different approaches. And we've talked just briefly about the elicitive approach. It doesn't do justice to it. We've talked briefly about the interest-based approach. It doesn't do justice to it. But these are the major thrusts of those approaches. And Yes.
I had a question about the interest-based negotiation and wondered how that would work in a context where you really reject the interests of the other group. I mean, at some level, but I mean, I know that often in public negotiations of things, people will talk about stuff in one set of terms when they're explicitly concealing their interests because they don't want to talk about those publicly. I mean, I guess the context I have for thinking about that is, I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or I have lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where parking is always a major problem. And so people know that the space in front of their house on the street isn't theirs. They know it's a public asset, but they feel entitled to it very strongly. And so when any discussion of traffic patterns comes up, people can't say directly what their real interest is. They'll talk about all kinds of how they don't like bicycles or whatever. They talk in a different language because they can't publicly that interest. So there are things like that where there's kind of an agreement that this isn't a good thing to want, but where people might have some level of conscience about not wanting to squash Muslims, say, in this country, that there's a very strong sense of religious tolerance, that you can't overtly say, no, we don't want a mosque, even though viscerally that's what you want. Wondering, in the interest-based negotiations, you want to elicit that because you want people to acknowledge what they really are.
Right.
But then how would that work in a situation where you're asking people to brainstorm how they could get to their interests, where you really want them to let go of those interests? You want to acknowledge that that's not for the common good. I just can imagine that being complicated in some situations.
I think it is complicated. And I think your example raises a really important point, and that is sometimes the interest isn't obvious. Uh-huh. I mean, you really have to probe and spend some time really understanding what their interests are. I mean, in the example of yesterday, was Reverend Falwell's interest to prevent a mosque? Let me ask you, what do you think Reverend Falwell's interest was? His position was, you know, we don't want a permit for the mosque.
Yeah, that he wanted to preserve a homogeneous community.
Okay, the interest was to preserve a homogeneous community. But could it have been that his interest was that he wanted to be seen as important among a group of people?
Right.
And could you satisfy that interest by, doing something different where he's going to feel important, like he's kind of an important person? So that's what I mean. I think you really have to think through, really, and sometimes you can't. I mean, you can't walk in and say, you know, Reverend Falwell, I think you've kind of got a big ego. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, you kind of really have to, you know, kind of get at it indirectly. Uh-huh. And finally, you can kind of figure out questions where you're indirectly figuring out, okay, it really is the ego thing more than anything else. Okay. Or you find out he stated some things publicly and he's in a corner. How can we effectively
help him get
out of the corner?
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing you have to really work through.
And in the Cambridge situation, you might realize and behind closed doors about these people's concern about wanting to have parking space and find a way that says, well, we'll allow public parking on the streets until 5:30 p.m. Most people are coming home to want to park. And so, you know, their interest is having space to park at their house.
I mean, the problem is there really isn't enough parking, but, unless you're going.
But those kinds of negotiated solutions where their interest is considered,
right.
But it's, even though they don't have a right to the whole thing, but they're too important to the solution.
Right.
Yeah, I had a student at Hebrew University who wrote a case study on exactly a street issue, and it was between an Orthodox Jewish community that didn't want secular Jews driving down the road on Saturdays. You know? So they had to work out some sort of solution, and what they ended up was that basically the whole neighborhood, there would be no car driving except for on a single road that they consented to, and the secular Jews also consented to it. But they were to a point of, you know, physical violence, throwing rocks at the cars.
Yeah, and, no, it's amazing.
You know,
it's a hot topic.
Right, right.
Well, I love what you were describing, the simplicity of trying to get the other side to just say yes to it's a lovely day, mm-hmm. this identification of commonality, and that you've got that sort of initial sort of place where you're not polarized. It really is kind of like takes all four of those steps, and in that one simple kind of clear way, distills it. That getting to yes and sort of in practice. I mean, it oversimplifies, but
right, right,
kind of creates a conceptual frame.
Right. Yes.
Do you find these techniques, do they work cross-culturally, or these techniques really work from a Western, you know, viewpoint and, you know, culturation and stuff like that? Or are they kind of really lost on somebody from the East? And if that's true, do they have people spending as much time thinking about getting to the same place but from their own framework?
I think that it's mixed. Certainly these techniques have been used all over the world by a group called the CMG, Conflict Management Group. It's an organization that Roger Fisher started, the co-author of the book Getting to Yes, and Conflict Management Group does negotiations all over Latin America, Asia, Africa, mm-hmm. at high levels with political officials. Mm-hmm. I would say it's been criticized by Lederach and others as being not culturally adaptable. In his book, he talks about there's such a focus on technique rather than on listening that we oftentimes, you know, end up, you know, having a poetry contest where nobody shows up. Mm-hmm. And he's saying we really do need to listen and try to develop what their approaches are. You know, in a lot of places, there's a lot of respect for elders. And they have a critical role in bringing about peace. Mm-hmm. And so you really, I think your question is very good, and I would say it's mixed.
Mm-hmm. And like the other part of the question, as far as other cultures, do they spend as much time thinking about it as we do as far as coming up with their own models? I mean, do they have models based on, you know, like elders making the peace and that kind of thing?
I don't know. Probably a lot of it is tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, they've had a certain tradition of how to solve problems. You know, there are certain places in, I can't remember which country, but if there are two different large extended family groups that have had tension, they arrange for marriages between the groups.
Okay.
I think it really depends a lot. I think some of them do, and some of them, you know, they're pretty much into blood revenge. Yeah, good question. Yes?
I wanted to share that I'm part of a intentionally diverse church. It's new to really live out racial reconciliation, and we found a combination of both techniques to be really successful, to start with interest-based negotiations where you're really listening, and you have to really accept that person's reality is their truth. Mm-hmm. Like if you're listening to the impact of racism on a black man or woman, and listen to what their interests are, and spend a time in prayer and reflection, and then come back and do the that now, where you, what are you willing to sacrifice in order to stay in relationship with each other, and come to, and it really works well, you know, to come to peace and come to solutions, you know, to really, the issues are always embracing multiple cultures, uh-huh. in the church, and making sure that there's a place, you know, for both.
So it really is getting to win-win, but oftentimes right. when you get to win-win, there is sacrifice. There's no there's no getting around that.
Right.
And so oftentimes the BATNA is really more of a, there can't be any agreement at all, and this is...
Well, it's agreement, it's sacrifice, but it's after the listening. After the listening.
So you're combining the in a sense, a listening approach,
right.
And a culturally... tailored or appropriate approach with more of the technique, which is really what I was hoping people would walk away with. What you need to do is you need to combine the two. So that's great. That's helpful. I'm glad you mentioned that.
So in addition to identifying interests, you're identifying perspective and worldview.
Right. Values.
And also, it's really interesting what ultimately, and you kind of touched on it with the Jerry Falwell character, is you realize that it's people who are afraid of change for their personal lives. They will express this outward investment in the collective, but what they're really afraid of is, how is this going to change me? Mm-hmm. You know, and when you can get to that and listen to the person's experience, it really helps people to move to the center and live out in relationship and agreement that everyone else ultimately has to sacrifice something. So,
Jill, I read about a little brief blurb, and you may know about this, in Pakistan, a recent breakdown of a process for negotiated settlement about a family, I think it's on the Pakistan border with Afghanistan, a Pashtun family, I believe, where the 11-year-old boy was walking with the 10 or 11-year-old girl from another sort of opposing tribe,
right.
And that was seen as shaming to the tribe, and the father of a daughter who was teaching the Quran, and she was 18 and beloved kind of in that community, was seen as needing to be punished for allowing this, and the tribal council was called. And they decided that a mass rape by the council of the 18-year-old daughter to permanently shame this family was the solution, which they carried out.
Right.
And this was in the paper. I don't know any more details, but it was so horrifying.
Right.
And it was sort of, I got the suggestion that they were seeing that World Health Organization needed to come in, or some outside body, because it's such an awful, horrid breakdown of the tribal kind of ability to negotiate a solution.
Right. Well, I did read about that. It was one of those things where it just makes you sick to your stomach. It's one thing. I think oftentimes the tribal approach can really be helpful in some of those settings. But clearly in this case, it was very destructive. And, you know, I think we want to be culturally appreciative, but there are certain basic standards that have to be, you know, that we just need to assume are there, and it's very sad to hear about something like that. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that, you know, there is a group in Pakistan where the currency is honor. I shouldn't say the currency, but the issue is honor, and preserving that honor is really critical. Your whole life is based on it, and the honor of the tribe, I guess, it's just sad. Well, I know that we're out of time. I just want to say that it's been a real pleasure. Try to remember that this stuff is not just social psychological, it's also spiritual. There is a spiritual dimension to it. I think that's undeniable. And I urge you to go out and live your faith and to be passionate about it. Okay, thank you.